Good afternoon, everyone. Okay, we will continue now with the study of the Muni Sutta from the Sutta Nipata. And now we are on page 23 from the translation, and we're on verse 11. First I will recite the Pali, and then I will give translation and then explanation.
Yada gato ma jato se satova pindang labeta paradat tupajivi nalang tutung no pini pachavati tang va pidira muning appamattang.
Okay, this verse is referring to one of the most important traditional monastic practices. This is a practice called Pindapata, which means going on alms round. Of course, this is a practice difficult to undertake in the United States, though I'm not convinced it's impossible. Perhaps in the springtime, I will try it.
But in the traditional countries of South and Southeast Asia, it's a very fundamental Buddhist practice. And this is the practice that has sustained the Buddhist monastic order through 25 centuries, a practice going back even before the time of the Buddha. And that is when anybody embarks upon a religious way of life, the religious life of spiritual seeking, they have no fixed way of receiving their basic means of sustenance, food. What they receive at ordination, a monk receives a bowl, an alms bowl. And that bowl becomes his means of sustenance. One uses this bowl as a way, an instrument for going on alms round, going from house to house to receive the offerings of people. Going on alms round, as I've said previously, it's not begging. The Buddhist monk does not ask people for anything. But one just goes silently with the bowl from door to door, standing a short time in front of each door, giving people the opportunity to make offerings. And within the basic framework of Buddha spirituality or even general Indian spirituality, it is not the monk who receives the food that gets the benefit, but it is the people who make the offerings, they consider themselves the ones who receive the blessing, the benefit, for being able to participate in this spiritual act, the act of practicing dana, generosity or giving. And so the Buddhist Sangha, the Buddhist monastic order, has survived for so many centuries through this mutually supportive relationship between the Sangha and the laity, whereby the laity provide the monks and nuns with their basic means of support, especially food, and the monks and nuns provide the teaching of the Dhamma to the lay people. And it is this alms bowl and the offering of food that symbolizes that act of support, of material support. And this act of giving, it's very basic in Indian spirituality. It doesn't even require Buddhism to be understood. In 1987, I was in McLeod Ganj taking treatment for my chronic headache condition from a Tibetan physician there. And I was staying in a Tibetan sort of, it was like a center, Tibetan center, where they had lodging facilities for guests. Then I saw that there was an Indian village right nearby. I thought, as an experiment, I bet I could go for Pindapata on alms round to that Indian village. And so I asked somebody, an Indian person who spoke English, to write out in the Indian language the words, "I am a Buddhist monk. I from Sri Lanka. I do not receive money. I do not receive raw food. I only receive cooked food. May all blessings be with you." And so I took my bowl. I went to the houses. When I arrived at the house, the people would be standing in front of the house. When they saw me coming, they ran into the house. They were afraid. They didn't know, what is a strange fellow doing? But I just stood there with the card in front of me, holding up the card. And probably the people were not even literate, because this is a very simple village, but there would always be a child amongst the adults, and the child would doubtlessly be going to school. And so they would send the child out. I would just stand there holding the card. Then the child would come out slowly, very cautiously. I'd hand the card over to the child. He would take it, read it, run back into the house, then come back, just signal for me to wait. And then 3 minutes, 5 minutes later, the people would come out with pots and start putting food into the bowl. And I do this from house to house. Of course, they all know this. It's sort of deeply ingrained in the consciousness that a sadhu or sannyasi goes from house to house collecting food. Okay, so this verse is speaking about this practice. And this practice in a traditional culture, you see, a problem in Buddhist cultures, I have to say, is that the Buddhist monks get ruined because the practice of this alms round becomes something already pre-established, so that, for example, in Thailand, there's a fixed time for the alms round. People are waiting by the sides of the street. They already have the food prepared, already prepare very nice food and packaged. And so you just walk by, people give everything very neatly into the bowl, and you just walk past and get everything for the day's meal and just back to the temple, the monastery, and everything is done. But when one is going, say, on an alms round through India, where people might be Buddhists, might not be Buddhists, there could be like Brahmin villages where people are hostile to a Buddhist monk, then it's a training in the mind. And even in Sri Lanka, which is predominantly Buddhist, but people, you see, the custom of alms rounds has largely faded out in Sri Lanka. Though people know it, but it's not regularly practiced. So if one goes on alms round, people generally don't have food already prepared. So if they're not expecting you as a monk, when you go, people will want to offer something, but they don't have food prepared at, if you'd come around at 10 o'clock, 9:30, 10 o'clock, in order to get food for the meal at 11 o'clock, they don't have food prepared. So you might get pieces of bread and banana. This is sort of the famous first day Pindapata round, is a meal of slices of bread and bananas. when you go the second day and they're expecting you, then they'll have rice and vegetable curries and whatever things nicely prepared. But the first day, one is just taking the chance, and one gets often just slices of bread and bananas. Okay, so here the verse is speaking about the monk who depends on others, relying on others for alms food. And sometimes he'll receive alms from the top portion, or the middle portion, or the remainder. This is, I would take this, the commentary explains this literally, as though one is getting the food from the top of the pot, from the middle of the pot, or from the bottom of the pot. But it would seem to me that whether the food is coming from the top, the middle, or the bottom of the pot, it's still the same quality. So I would take this more symbolically. Either one is getting high quality, well-prepared food, or just ordinary, medium quality food, or sometimes just leftovers, things that have been heated up from the previous day. Whatever, one receives it all with an equal mind. Always one has to be equally thankful, equally feel equal gratitude towards the donors, not discriminating, thinking, this person gives very generously, very sumptuous and delicious food. This person just gives ordinary food. And these people, they don't give with any special care or respect. They just give leftovers. But one just receives everything the same and extends the same metta, the same loving kindness, the same blessings towards all, not flattering some and not speaking with disrespect or denigrating those who give the poor quality food. One develops this, it's called the quality of the quality of equanimity and equality of mind towards all benefactors. Okay, so this is a person, one of the persons that they call a sage. Okay, now we come to the next verse. Muning charantang viratang metunasma yo yo pane na upani bhajate kvachi Mada pamada viratang vipamutang tang va pidira muning vedayanti. The sage who wanders refraining from sexual intercourse, who in youth, I'm translating very literally from the original text, does not bind himself to anything, who has detached himself from pride and from indolence, who is liberated, he is the one that the wise call a sage. Okay, in this verse, the Buddha is speaking about he's praising the sage as one who has detached himself from that very powerful fetter of sexual desire. And the Buddha doesn't, of course, he doesn't require all of his disciples to take up this vow or practice of brahmacharya, the vow of celibacy. But for those who enter upon the monastic life, that vow becomes a requirement, a necessity. And it becomes a necessity because the monastic life is a life dedicated to fulfilling the practice of purity. The practice of purity in conduct, the practice of purification of mind, the practice of purification of wisdom, of understanding. And according to the Buddha's teaching, one of the most powerful afflictions or defilements that keeps us bound within this world, the world of samsara, the world of birth and death, is the force of sensual craving, sensual desire, craving that arises and operates through the five senses, craving through the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body. And that craving, most of all, it operates through the mind. And so to purify the mind, one has to begin at least at the level of conduct. And a very, very effective measure for purifying the mind of sensual desire is to stop up that tendency for desire to express itself through sensual behavior, sexual behavior. By stopping up that outward expression of sexual desire, then that force of sexual desire presents itself in front of the mind so that one can deal with it directly. Of course, this is not advisable for everyone, but for those who really want to follow the path of purity to its higher reaches, that is the approach that should be taken. And the Buddha, you see, in the India of the Buddha's time, it was the belief amongst the Brahmins that one should order one's life according to a particular pattern. In one's youth, one observes celibacy during the period when one becomes a student. As a Brahmin student from the age of 12 to 24, one, of course, as a child, one is celibate, but then from 12 to 24, one becomes a student, one observes celibacy. Then, at the age of 24, and this is for a male, I don't know what the age I think would be lower for a female who is expected to marry quite young. At the age of 24, the male will marry, raise a family, till he reaches middle age. In middle age, the man and the woman together, man and wife, then go, this is a stage called vanaprastha, setting out for the woods. They go together, they leave behind, the children are now able to take care of themselves. Together, they go and they study the scriptures, undertake religious practices. I'm not sure whether they have to observe celibacy at that, in that stage. But then when one reaches pretty close to old age, maybe in one's 60s or so, then one enters upon the stage called sannyasa. That's the stage of full renunciation. When one, then the man has to leave behind his wife and set out as a wandering ascetic, observing full celibacy. Okay, this pattern was not accepted by the Buddha. The Buddha himself and many of the Buddha's contemporaries, as young men, they set out on the life of renunciation. And then when the Buddha became a spiritual teacher, at the age of 36 already, he was the enlightened one. He was teaching at the age of 36. And he had many kulaputtas, that is, young men of good family, coming to him, seeking ordination, seeking to become monks. Even he had the age for becoming bhikkhu, higher ordination, is 20 from conception. So that would be 19 years of age. in terms of our way of counting age. And those who become novices, even from the age of 12, one can become a novice, even younger. And so these will be youngsters who will have sensual desire, full strength in them. And so the Buddha didn't make any requirement of reaching old age to take the vow of celibacy. And yet the Buddha would teach them methods of training to subdue sensual desire within the mind. And that is why the Buddha here in this verse praises those who have abstained even in youth from sexual desire, from sexual involvements, and who have observed this life of detachment, of renunciation, all through their life. And this one, he says, who then not only detaches himself from sensuality, but then overcomes and liberates himself from pride and from negligence. Those are two other strong defilements. Pride, which can arise on account of one's purity, thinking, I am pure, I am celibate, I am a brahmachari. And so one has to overcome that pride and be humble and respectful of others. And then indolence or negligence, that is, means not being persistent in one's spiritual striving. And so one who detaches himself from that pride and indolence, this one, the Buddha says, is a sage. Okay, next verse.
Anyaya lokaṃ paramata dāsiṃ ogaṃ samudaṃ atitāya tādiṃ taṃ cinagantaṃ asitāṃ anāsavaṃ taṃ vāpidīrā muniṃ vaidayanti.
Okay, the meaning, one who has known the world, who has perceived the highest truth, or I would say the supreme goal, who has crossed the flood and sea of existence, who has cut the ties, who has no clinging to sense objects, who is free from intoxicants or from the asavas, he is the one that the wise call a sage. According to the commentary, this verse was spoken by the Buddha with reference to his half-brother named Nanda. And there's a story about this monk named Nanda that I should tell. That's sort of the background to the verse. Yeah, Nanda was the Buddha's half-brother. They had the same father who was King Suddhodana, but Nanda would have been born of a different mother. And now, when the Buddha was enlightened, became the enlightened one, when he was already a famous teacher, Nanda was still a layperson living the household life, not yet married. But he became engaged, and he was due to marry a very beautiful girl from the Shakyan clan. Her name was Janapada Kalyani, which means something like the lovely one from the country. Perhaps it was just a title that she was given. And on the day of the wedding, the Buddha came to the house where the wedding ceremony was taking place. He came with his alms bowl to receive alms, and everybody filled his bowl, presented him with alms, and Nanda was the last one to make an offering of alms into the Buddha's bowl. And so then the Buddha gave his bowl to Nanda and said, "Nanda, please carry my bowl back to the monastery for me." And Nanda, since he was a junior half-brother, he was very shy. He didn't want to refuse his famous half-brother, the Buddha. And so he said, "Yes, sir." And so they were walking out the door, the Buddha in front, Nanda behind. And just as they walked out the door, Nanda's fiance said, "Please, dear sir, don't be long, hurry back." And Nanda turned and said, "I'll be back soon." Okay, they walked along to the monastery, Nanda behind the Buddha. They got to the monastery. The Buddha just kept on walking through the gate into the monastery till they were into the inner chamber of the monastery. Then the Buddha took the bowl from Nanda, and he didn't dismiss them and say, "Now you can go back, Nanda." So Nanda just continued to stand there. It was sort of polite for him to wait until he was dismissed. So the Buddha, as if interpreting Nanda's persistence there as a sign, said, "So you would like to become a monk, Nanda?" And Nanda was too shy to refuse his senior brother. So he said, "Yes, sir." So the Buddha had Nanda ordained as a monk right there. Okay, but of course this would have been very disappointing. And in terms of our culture and our values, it seems somewhat unfair of the Buddha to do this. But I think the Buddha would have been really thinking in terms not of conventional values, but of Nanda's long-term ultimate good. But Nanda didn't immediately take to the monastic life, but after his ordination, he was all the time, the other monks would always see him sitting around under trees, on the lawns, on the benches of the monastery, sort of sitting, sort of almost lamenting, looking very sad, mournful, melancholy. And they reported this to the Buddha, and the Buddha called Nanda and said, "Nanda, what is the matter with you?" And Nanda said, "Venerable sir, all the time I am thinking about my fiance Janapada Kalyani, and still I am so much in love with her, and I just couldn't leave her behind like this." And so then the Buddha thought to himself that he will use a certain skillful means to detach Nanda from his infatuation with his fiancée. And so he asked Nanda, have you ever made a journey to the heaven of the 33 devas? And Nanda said, no. So then he asked Nanda, would you like to make a journey there? Nanda said, yes, I would. So then the Buddha used his spiritual power to take Nanda to the Tavatingsa heaven, the heaven of the 33 devas. And when they arrived there, a group of heavenly nymphs came out to greet Nanda. And Nanda, when he saw them, he was completely stricken by them. They were so beautiful. He was absolutely infatuated with them. Then the Buddha asked him, do you think these nymphs are beautiful? And Nanda said, oh, they're wonderful. Then the Buddha said, I'll guarantee you that if you lead the monk's life properly, then when you pass away in your next life, you will be able to marry 500 of these beautiful nymphs in the heaven of the 33. Okay, so Nanda, when they came back to the human world, Nanda started living the monk's life very, very diligently. And so all the monks were impressed or struck by this change in Nanda's behavior. Why has he changed so much? And they asked him, why are you now become very diligent, very, very scrupulous in your behavior? And he said, well, the Buddha has promised me that if I live the monk's life diligently, in my next life I will be reborn in the heaven and I will have 500 celestial maidens as my wives. Then the monks were astonished and said, what kind of monk are you? That's not the purpose of the monk's life. And then they criticized him and blamed him and said, Nanda is just a hireling. He's just almost betraying the purpose of the monk's life. And when Nanda heard this, then he became very angry with himself and started leading the monk's life properly, striving for the real goal. He came to the Buddha, asked to learn the subject of meditation, practiced very diligently, and then he achieved arhatship. But the other monks still continued to criticize and to blame Nanda. And when the Buddha heard this, then he told the monks that they shouldn't blame Nanda now, that Nanda has now reached the final goal and has achieved liberation of mind. And then the Buddha spoke this verse in which he praised Nanda as one who has fully known the world, who has seen the ultimate goal, who has crossed the flood and sea of existence, cut the ties, who has no clinging to sense objects, who is free from the intoxicants. Okay, we come to the next verse. I think these next two verses should be taken together. So I'll recite them both together, read the translation, then give some explanation. Asama ubo dura vihara vutino gihi dara posi amamo chasu bato parapa Parapanarodaya gihi asanyato
Nichang muni rakati pani neyato Sikhi yatani lagivo vihangamo Hangsasano peti javang kudachanang Evangihi nanu karoti bhikkhuno Muni no vivitasavanam hijayato.
Okay, these verses, when you listen to the translation, please be a little restrained because I'm going to give explanation and they have to be taken in context. And they have to be taken in balance with other passages from the suttas. Don't just jump to quick conclusions and then build interpretations upon them out of context. Okay, the sage who is accustomed to living in distant places, the egoless and well-conducted one, and the householder who supports a family, they are not equal. For the householder is unrestrained and destroys living beings. The sage is self-restrained and protects living beings. The blue-necked peacock, which flies through the air, never approaches the speed of the swan. Similarly, the householder can never resemble the monk who is endowed with the qualities of a sage who meditates aloof in the jungle. Okay, first of all, if we just look at the verses, they seem to be speaking in generalities. But according to the commentary, they aren't speaking in generalities, but they're speaking, or at least the first verse, number 14, is speaking with reference to a particular case. This is the particular case or story. Okay, there was a monk who was living in a forest near a village. He was living a meditative life, very, very strict, austere meditative life. And in the village, there was a trapper who would go into the forest in order to trap animals, to catch them, and then to kill them for his living and to sell the meat. And so every day that monk would come into the village and go on alms round, and the trapper would go into the village to catch animals. And then when he catches them, he would kill them and then sell the meat. And when the monk and the trapper would pass each other, they would smile at each other. The monk didn't try to preach to the trapper to dissuade him from his way of living, but he just went about his quiet way as a meditating monk. And so people came to assume that the two were friends and that they were actually collaborating, and that the monk was in some way helping the trapper to find animals to kill and to sell. And so people started blaming the monk and accusing him of collaborating with the trapper. And so when reports of this came to the Buddha then explained to the people in the village that there was just no similarity at all between this monk and the trapper, that they were in fact living two completely different ways of life. And then the Buddha spoke this verse in praise of the monk. That is the way the commentary explains the background story. or provides a background story for the verse. Okay, but it's also possible to take this verse not as speaking with reference to a particular case, but as speaking in more general terms. But in that case, I don't think that a Buddhist householder should become offended and think, ah, this verse is drawing an unfavorable comparison between Buddhist monks and us Buddhist householders. But rather, I think one could see the verse as speaking in general terms about a contrast between the monastic way of life in its original, pristine, ideal form, and the way of life in the world without the uplifting, transforming influence of the Buddha's teaching. Now, in its ideal, pristine form, the Buddhist monastic life, in fact, it wasn't even a monastic life in the sense of having fixed monasteries with fixed monastic routines, but it was a life largely of wandering from town to town, from village to village throughout the year without fixed residence, in which everyone who entered upon this very difficult life was fully committed to seeking the ultimate goal, in which people from good families, well-established families, would renounce all of the privileges of their position, taking this very difficult way of life up, receiving directions, instructions from the Buddha himself and from the great Buddhist disciples, devoting so much of their time to meditation, striving very diligently for the final goal, and in which so many were able to attain the final goal, observing the discipline very scrupulously, always committed to harmlessness, to purity, to truthfulness, to having few possessions, no more possessions than one could fit into a little shoulder bag and an alms bowl, going without, with the bear, just three robes, maybe one extra robe to wear when bathing. Okay, and then if one looks at the ordinary life in the world, just open the newspapers and just even project back into ancient India, there would have been the same thing. Maybe the weapons would have been less sophisticated, but there would have been this state fighting against that state, these rulers cheating their countrymen through taxation of their wealth, these families fighting against these families, fathers fighting against the fathers of this family, fighting against the fathers of that family, always killing, stealing, adultery, falsehood, false speech, quarreling, harsh speech, anger. This is the way of life in the world. So contrast these two ways of life, and one sees that, in fact, that there is a great difference between the monastic life or the life of renunciation in its ideal form and the life of the world without the uplifting influence of the Buddha's teaching. And so when the Buddha's teaching acts upon the world, acts upon the household life, then it has a transforming influence. It moves that household life in the direction of that ideal spiritual life by imparting to it the principles of not destroying life, not taking what is not given, not engaging in sexual misconduct, not speaking falsehood, not using intoxicants, observing the 10 principles of wholesome conduct, trying to practice the 4 divine qualities of loving kindness, compassion, altruistic joy, equanimity. But all of those uplifting qualities are coming from the spiritual depths of the life of renunciation and engaging the life of the world and drawing it upwards and away from its ordinary movement, which is the movement towards sensual enjoyment, towards conflict, quarrels, destructiveness, which we can see so obviously. Just open any newspaper or turn onto any news channel on the internet. Everything is about corruption in Congress, fighting in this country or that country, conflicts between this community and that community. That is, whether you go back, open a newspaper 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 50 years ago, it's always the same stories. Just the names are different, weapons are different, communities are different, but the basic story is the same. Okay, so then the next verse says, the blue-necked peacock which flies through the air never approaches the speed of the swan. Similarly, the householder can never resemble the monk who is endowed with the qualities of a sage who meditates aloof in the jungle. And this verse, too, has to be taken with a great deal of qualifications. There's another passage in the suttas in which the Buddha says, it is not the one who has gone forth that I praise, it is not the householder that I praise, but it is the one who lives according to the Noble Eightfold Path that I praise. So whether it is one who has gone forth, whether it is one who lives the household life, if that is the person of right practice, the one who practices the Noble Eightfold Path, then that is the person that I praise. So it is not because a person is a monk living aloof in the jungle, or because a person is a householder, that that person is automatically praised by the Buddha. And again, it's not because a person is a monk that that person is necessarily a better meditator than a person who is a householder. And from my own personal experience, I know that there are many householders who are far better meditators than many monks. And in fact, this is what I've heard coming from great Burmese meditator Venerable Mahasi Soyador. I didn't hear this. I never saw Venerable Mahasi Soyador. But this is what is reported that he has said. And Venerable Pa Auk Soyador, who's still alive, both have said this. Their best meditation disciples, women take cheer, are women lay practitioners. Not monks, not male lay practitioners, not nuns, but women lay practitioners. Probably because they have had the most direct, forceful experience of dukkha, of suffering in life. So that is their spur for suffering. Spur for practice. The monks are always trying to figure things out in terms of their charts and tables and scholastic learning, so they don't practice so diligently. But the women, lay followers, don't try to figure things out in terms of conceptual schemes. They just get the instructions, practice diligently, and get the results.
Okay, I thank you all for your attention, and may, since this is our first Saturday in the new year, at least the first, it is actually the first Saturday in the new year, so I wish you all the blessings of the Triple Gem throughout this new year. Okay, we share the merits with the devas. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumodipa chirang rakantu sasanam.